is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, November 25, 2004. On this Thanksgiving Day, we bring you a special documentary looking at the Indigenous peoples of the Americas. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Please stay with us. Thanksgiving Day, a day when the Indigenous people of this country go all but forgotten. On today's edition of Free Speech Radio News, we go to Bolivia to bring you a documentary on what often goes unreported by the English-speaking press, and we focus on the Indigenous peoples of the Americas. After a period of relative calm, a political storm is once again churning in the landlocked Andean country, in the midst of an increasingly tense situation, including nearly 2 weeks of intermittent strikes throughout the country. Shannon Young and Vladimir Flores bring you this special half-hour look at social movements shaping one of the most politically volatile climates in the hemisphere. Please stay with us.
Few countries have social movements as vibrant as those in the Andean nation of Bolivia. Although rich in natural resources, Bolivia is the poorest nation in Latin America. The high poverty rate could perhaps explain some of the intensity of the country's political activism. But to understand the contemporary social movements of modern Bolivia, one has to look at the roots of resistance during the colonial era. Aymara historian Felix Pazzi traces Bolivia's modern indigenous resistance movement to two important figures in Bolivia's past.
One precisely is from the colonial era. I'm talking about 1780 with Cattaris' movement that sought the reconstitution of the pre-colonial society, which has stood out in the historical memory in the contemporary indigenous movement. And another of the movements, it is in the Republican era or age at the end of the turn of the century in 1900. It's a movement identified with Pablo Zarate Vilica. Perhaps these two will represent a milestone in the memory of the contemporary indigenous movement.
In 1781, Tupac Katari, along with his wife, Bartolina Sisa, led an army of 40,000 indigenous rebels in a siege of La Paz. From high above the city, the rebels effectively blockaded shipments of food and goods to the urban Spanish and mestizo population. The effects of the scarcity caused by the 109-day blockade shook the ruling elites of the time. The tactics of the 18th-century anti-colonial guerrillas were echoed in the October 2003 upheaval known as the Gas War. Blockades originating in the rural areas spread to the indigenous city of El Alto, which overlooks its wealthier sister city, La Paz. Felipe Quispe was one of the principal organizers of the 2003 resistance in El Alto. For the Aymara leader, the use of 200-year-old rebel methods in a contemporary social mobilization is only natural.
Since colonial times, we have waged communal wars, tribal wars, against colonialism, as well in the age of the Republic, and up until the present day. Rather, the indigenous in Bolivia, we are prepared, we're disciplined to this rhythm, to this type of violent struggle. It's not strange, but almost rather common and current. In this way, we're not rehearsing. For example, since April and September of the year 2000, we have blocked roadways with stones, carpeting highways with stones, blocking the arrival of our agricultural products from the countryside and blocking the circulation of vehicles. In reality, we completely surround the government.
Another characteristic that today's movements share with Tupac Katari's rebellion is that it is led by the indigenous majority. In Bolivia, over 60% of the population self-identifies as either Aymara, Quechua, or Guarani. An important aspect of indigenous cultural identity is the traditional use of the coca leaf, as the historian Felix Pazzi explains.
As long as there is coca, there will always be a very strong indigenous movement. precisely because those who cultivate coca are Aymaras and Quechuas. Facing the submission of absolute poverty, coca is the only economic alternative for the indigenous people, which is why as long as coca problem goes unresolved, this movement will continue.
Bolivia is the world's third largest cultivator of coca, after Peru and Colombia. In fact, the coca growers themselves have become a major force within Bolivian politics. Although Bolivia has a history of unionized agricultural workers, the policy of coca eradication served as a powerful catalyst to organize the coca farmers into federations. While the coca leaf has been cultivated in the Andean region for millennia, the relatively recent invention of cocaine has put the traditional crop at the center of a conflict known as the drug war. Organized coca farmers like Silvia Lasarte from the Union Federation of Coca Growers of the Cochabamban Tropics regard eradication policies as a U.S.-sponsored attack on their culture and centuries of traditions.
La coca en estado natural no es ningún dañino.
Coca in its natural state is not harmful in any way. It's born of a seed, it grows, and it produces a leaf. This is why, for us, we consider it a natural plant, the sacred coca leaf. Beyond that, it's medicine. In addition, we in no way defend narco-trafficking because in Bolivia, we don't have within any province or in any state a factory or industry that produces the chemical substances. These chemical substances, which are used to make drugs out of coca, come from other countries, and we aren't responsible for that. The government is. There it is, in the borders, and how does it pass, enter into the Tropic of Cochabamba? In the roads of the Tropic of Cochabamba, there are DEA agents. So, if they are constantly guarding, then how are these substances coming into the Tropic of Cochabamba?
Alieta Ortiz Condori is a reporter for Radio Soberania in the Chapare, the country's principal coca-growing region. She says that the eradication policies of the war on drugs and the militarization of the region has galvanized the local population.
En Trópico de Cochabamba hay mucha violación de los derechos humanos.
In the Tropic of Cochabamba, there's a lot of human rights violations because there's forced eradication. So the people don't want their coca eradicated. So, as part of this, women are kicked by the agents of the rural patrol, children are hit, or fathers are abused and detained in front of their children. So the kids, the little ones, are living a sort of vengeance towards the soldiers. They already hate them because they've seen their father abused, their mother scream. This is why, in the Tropic of Cochabamba, life for children is very different. You could say they're already reared to be against the soldiers, because these very ones teach them, because they break into their homes, eat their food. Many times, they take their belongings, steal their machetes. So this is the reality that one lives in the Tropic.
The situation reached a boiling point in early 2002 when the legal markets for coca leaves in the department of Cochabamba were shut down by government decree. What began as peaceful mobilizations by coca farmers to try to reopen the markets turned into violent confrontations in what later became known as the Coca War. Later that year, Cocalero leader Evo Morales was nearly elected to the presidency, losing to Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada by a razor-thin margin of less than a percentage point and a half. Evo Morales is currently an influential representative in the Bolivian Congress, in addition to holding the highest position within the Federation of Coca Growers. Morales sees the war on drugs as something other than a crusade against drug addiction.
They have it all under their control. And here, the struggle is precisely over the natural resources. I'm convinced, compañeros, that drugs and the fight against narcotrafficking is a pretext for the United States to gain more power and control over Latin American countries, over their governments. They're a pretext to make us submit. They're a pretext to recolonize us. They're a pretext to take over our natural resources. This is why this is a completely political issue, a geopolitical problem, and beyond that, an identity problem. That's where we're fighting.
After narrowly defeating Evo Morales in the 2002 presidential election, Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, also known as Goni, began his second term as president. During his first administration in the 1990s, Sánchez de Lozada implemented a number of policies praised by the International Monetary Fund and criticized by domestic social movements. Among them was the capitalization, or semi-privatization, of several of Bolivia's state-owned industries, including YPFB, the National Hydrocarbons Company. For his second term, Sánchez de Lozada had even more drastic measures in mind. With the administrative decisions of the country's gas reserves in the hands of private energy corporations like Repsol, British Gas, and Totalfina, the next step became the massive export of gas to foreign markets. While countries like Argentina and Brazil receive Bolivian natural gas through pipelines, delivering the resource to new markets, like the United States and Mexico, would require a different route. Sánchez de Lozada's plan was to ship gas through a port in the hands of Bolivia's historical enemy, Chile. In 1880, Chile seized Bolivia's only access to the ocean, leaving the country landlocked. A combination of factors, including the denationalization of the energy reserves, the rock-bottom prices that transnationals pay for Bolivian gas, and the plans to export the resource through a Chilean port, led to a social upheaval in October 2003 dubbed the Gas War. Bolivia! Bolivia! Mobilizations began with road blockades in the rural areas outside of La Paz, then spread throughout the country, most notably in the poverty-ridden indigenous city of El Alto. Before long, the city of La Paz began to feel the effects of the blockades due to the scarcity of food and gas. In a desperate attempt to impose order, Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada sent a military convoy to break up the blockades. This resulted in over 30 deaths on October 12th, which sparked widespread support for the resistance in El Alto across a variety of sectors of the population and led to the nationwide call for Sánchez de Lozada's resignation. Leonilda Zurita, a Cocalero leader from the Chapare, explains what provoked people from her area to become involved in the gas war.
Día que pasaba, nosotros más nos movilizamos porque el dolor, la sangre que derrama los hermanos de Aymaras, pues.
As the days passed, we mobilized more because the pain, the blood spilled by our Aymara brothers, unified us to mobilize throughout the country. The government wanted us to make us give up organizations, but they couldn't. They brought out their war tanks. They put all of their soldiers out in the streets. Seeing that massacre, that pain and grief, we women had to participate in the marches. But by then, after days with so many dead, the chant had changed. It was no longer no to the sale of gas, neither through Chile nor Peru, but rather it changed to Goni, get out, murderer of Bolivia.
Goni, asesino de Bolivia.
On October 17, 2003, Sánchez de Lozada finally called it quits and fled the presidential palace in a helicopter, later taking an airplane to Miami, Florida. He currently lives with his family in Washington, D.C. His vice president, Carlos Mesa, then became the president of Bolivia. During a now-famous speech given after Goni's flight, Mesa made a promise to the residents of El Alto. Herbert Choque, the secretary general of the Union Federation of Bolivian Mine Workers, describes the scene that day.
As a result of the events of October, the then Vice President Carlos Mesa made a promise in El Alto that he was going to respect the decision made in the popular assembly that we held in El Alto. And we clearly stated, we are going to nationalize our gas and we are going to industrialize it. But unfortunately, all of this was just lip service with no serious outcome for his country or his people.
Rather than nationalize the country's hydrocarbons, Carlos Mesa promoted a countrywide referendum on the matter. Consisting of five vaguely worded questions, the referendum was criticized for its complicated legal phraseology and potential for multiple interpretations. Many citizens, like El Alto resident Marcial Canavari, said that the referendum should have consisted of only one clearly worded question: nationalization or no?
Porque aquí, lamentablemente, el pueblo no ha participado en la elaboración de las preguntas.
Unfortunately, the people here haven't participated in the wording of the questions. Whether you vote yes or no, in this case, both responses come out in their favor. But sadly, they don't speak the people's language. It's a high Spanish, an elevated lexicon. These ballots need to use a Spanish that the people speak.
El castellano que habla el pueblo.
Regardless of the outcome of the vote, the referendum could only affect future energy projects. The results would have no bearing on any of the energy contracts that had already been signed during the Sánchez de Lozada administration, as referendum participant Victor Carlos explains.
There are already 78 contracts signed with foreign gas companies, and they aren't going to be revised. These were recently signed with the companies, and in reality, they go against the population, the dignity, and the economy of our country.
All five questions received a majority yes vote, and President Mesa declared victory. Due to the vague phraseology of the questions, the interpretation of the results were set to cause a power struggle in Bolivia's parliament. However, President Carlos Mesa didn't wait for congressional debate to begin negotiating export deals. Just days after the referendum, Mesa met with his Argentine counterpart to sign a deal increasing by over 50% the daily amount of gas exported to Argentina. Besides exporting gas to the markets of Argentina and Brazil, President Mesa has also announced his intentions to sell gas to Mexico through the Peruvian port of Ilo. Although Mesa presents this as a favorable alternative to the Chilean route, many experts say that a pipeline that would have to cross altitudes of up to 4,000 meters would make the Peruvian option cost prohibitive. Bolivian energy analyst Carlos Arce says that if Bolivia exports the proposed amount of natural gas, there will be nothing left for internal consumption.
Here the strategy of the gas companies is to export. Export as soon as possible to make back the money invested and to use up the reserves that Bolivia has. Together with Brazil, Argentina, which will possibly reach the same volume as Brazil, and the special exportation to Mexico, Bolivia will be promising the entirety of her proven reserves. What would be left for Bolivia? There will be the possibility of using the probable, that's to say, the reserves whose existence still isn't certain.
This is why many social sectors in Bolivia are demanding the nationalization of the country's gas reserves. Energy analyst Arce explains that there are precedents for this in 20th century Bolivian history.
This country has nationalized natural gas two times. Once in 1939, expropriating from Standard Oil, which produced the war between Bolivia and Paraguay in the region of El Chaco. In 1969, there was again a nationalization with an expropriation from Gulf Oil. So this is a repeated story. It's not some Bolivian craziness. It's not the product of the work of subversive political or intellectual groups, etc. No, it's a legitimate demand with a history based on the people's experience. So this is the reason why natural gas is so important for us, and it's also so important for the region.
But the call for nationalization of the country's gas isn't the only demand to come out of the mobilizations of October 2003. Shortly after Goni's return to the country of his childhood, the United States, calls for his extradition began. El Alto resident Juan Marc is one of many demanding a criminal trial for Sánchez de Lozada.
Como bolivianos nos duele mucho que nuestra... nuestro gas, nuestra propiedad.
As Bolivians, it really hurts us that our gas, our property, has been given away to transnational companies by Goni. This Goni needs to be in prison because, as a consequence of the defense of our rights, of our property, many of our brothers have died. And even though the current president promised that he would be tried shortly, up until now, nothing has happened.
No pasa nada.
In December of 2003, over 50 organizations formed a coalition to bring charges against Sánchez de Lozada and some of his cabinet ministers and make the criminal trial a reality. Rogelio Maite, coordinator for the legal commission of the committee to put the ex-president on trial, explains the objectives of the commission.
Lograr evitar la impunidad.
To prevent the impunity of governing aggressors, specifically of Sánchez de Lozada and his collaborators, against the civilian population, who, through the use of military armament and of the armed forces, have fatally repressed the people of La Paz and El Alto, with over 60 victim fatalities.
As part of the effort to put Sánchez de Lozada on trial, a nationwide petition campaign was launched during the summer with the goals of collecting 1 million signatures. On the day of Mesa's energy referendum, Elias Domingo was staffing a table to solicit signatures for the petition outside of a polling place in El Alto.
All of El Alto is behind this. As you, the press, can see, they are waiting in line to sign. I think that all the people of El Alto agree with this.
The goal for signatures during the petition campaign was set at 1 million in order to demonstrate to Congress the level of support for the trial among the electorate. Trying an official such as a former president or cabinet minister is a two-step process. First, authorization is needed from the Bolivian Congress, which requires a two-thirds majority in favor of the legal process. Only then can criminal charges be leveled. In October of 2004, week-long mobilizations were held to mark the one-year anniversary of the gas war and to commemorate the dead. On October 14th, Congress voted to authorize the criminal trial against Sánchez de Lozada and his cabinet ministers. Bolivia has an important legal precedent for trying and sentencing an ex-head of state, as Pamela Ledesma of the Permanent Human Rights Assembly of Bolivia explains.
We already have a history of having sentenced the ex-dictator Luis García Mesa and his collaborators. They're now serving a 30-year term in prison. The trial lasted nearly 10 years, but the sentence was handed down and we were able to extradite him from Brazil when he had escaped, and he's now serving time in the Chonchocoro prison in La Paz. Now we're thinking of doing it again, but we hope that it won't take that long. But we can hang on for 10 years or even more. These deeds cannot be left in impunity.
But for attorney Rosemary Acha, much more than petition drives and mass mobilizations are needed to successfully sentence Sánchez de Lozada.
Not just pressure from the streets, which for the people is the most basic form of fighting, but also pressure from the desks. What is lacking among organizations is a certain strategic thinking about how to carry out the struggle, which isn't going to be easy, obviously. At various moments in the process, there have been roadblocks, because that's how power is. It has mechanisms for covering itself. But I think that one of the principal objectives is to put behind bars all of these people responsible for all of these deaths and suffering during the gas war. And this is the work that now falls to all of us.
Another project on the horizon for Bolivia's political groups is what is being called the Constituent Assembly, which would be made up of indigenous representatives from the country's majority ethnic nationalities. Congressman Evo Morales explains the purpose of such an assembly.
Why are we now talking about re-establishing the country through a constituent assembly? Because in the year 1825, we Quechuas, Aymaras, and Guaranis didn't participate in the founding of the country. It was founded by the same liberal invaders. Where we Quechuas, Aymaras, and Guaranis are the majority, there needs to be a re-establishing of the country by the majority of the constituents. There needs to be a constituent election if we are thinking of a peaceful transformation. As we've said, through a political instrument, we need power and territory. As far as power, we are well on our way. But for territory, we still have a ways to go, because territory means all the natural resources.
Since the era of Spanish colonization up until the present day, Bolivia's resources have mostly benefited foreigners who come to extract her natural wealth. The boatloads of silver from the once famous mines of Potosí helped to make Spain the superpower that it was. Now, a new group of Spaniards, arriving under the corporate logo of Repsol, stand to make a fortune extracting and exporting the liquid gold of the 21st century, natural gas. At the same time, foreign soldiers from the north, under the modern crusade of the war on drugs, are clashing with a 3,000-year-old traditional crop and the descendants of the Inca Empire that gave it cultural value. According to Bolivian sociologist Silvia Rivera Cusicanqui, This campaign against the Andean plant has created a renewed interest in the traditional uses and culture of the coca leaf.
Bolivia is a very struggling society, and we are kind of, you know, fierce, and we have a certain fame for dignity and fearfulness. And part of this, the rage of the people of being, you know, told what to do and controlled and blackmailed by the U.S. is to chew coca. You know, and some part of it is like an act of resistance towards these imperial orders, you know.
Rivera goes on to point out that the coca leaf has been used in contemporary protests. As an example, she tells of how the coca leaf has helped to prolong hunger strikes, because when chewed, the leaf helps to alleviate hunger pains. But one can only speculate as to what the future holds for Bolivia and her two geopolitical cards of coca and natural gas. U.S. soldiers and DEA agents working in coca-growing regions were recently granted immunity from prosecution under Bolivian law, which many critics view as a carte blanche for committing abuses against traditional coca growers. After continued pressure from social sectors, the Bolivian Congress has come up with a proposed energy plan that, although does not allow for outright nationalization, slaps 50% royalty fees on the energy corporations extracting the resource at the wellhead. President Mesa has threatened to veto the plan, and what appears to be an extremely well-funded campaign calling for secession from Bolivia has appeared in the gas-rich areas of Tarija and Santa Cruz. Since winning independence from Spain in 1825, Bolivia has been through 200 changes of government, including a number of coups, counter-coups, and popular uprisings. After an era of dictatorship, Bolivia became a democracy in the 1980s. However, Bolivian society continues to be marked by extreme poverty, government corruption, and high-level drug trafficking. But since the beginning of this century, Bolivian society has also found itself at the forefront of a new type of resistance against corporate neocolonialism. IRPA from the Tinku Youth Network says that this is the legacy of a centuries-long struggle that is being passed on to the Bolivian youth of today.
No nos olvidemos que hace 512 años llegaron.
We haven't forgotten that 512 years ago, the Spanish arrived from the West, and they didn't respect these lands or cultures. There was an ethnocide and a genocide. So from that moment, our cultures enter into a dark age. But now, there's been 500 years of so much exploitation, massacre, discrimination, and exclusion. That's why now we're having to strengthen ourselves in a way and revitalize ourselves through our cultures.
Shannon and Vladimir Flores bringing us that special documentary from Bolivia. On tomorrow's Free Speech Radio News, we have another special documentary as high school students in New York City look at their dreams and the struggles ahead for the future as they delve into two pieces of legislation, the DREAM Act and the Patriot Act. Please join us for that special presentation. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.